Make it work in your run. Don't forget, you can hear more from Scott and Hayley on Must Watch BBC Sounds each and every week. And email us with your thoughts on the show we've reviewed or your own recommendations anytime at mustwatch@bbc.co.uk. Matt Chorley's coming up next.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Hey, it's 2 o'clock. I'm Matt Chorley coming to you live from the Labour Party conference in Liverpool, where it's all been kicking off. All smiles for Rachel Reeves. But are the Labour faithful and real voters quite as pleased with her big speech? Plus, what happened when I got behind the wheel of a tractor? What happened when I met Tony Adams, the football legend? Tony Adams, of course I interviewed him in front of John Lennon's Imagine Piano. And you can now listen to live news 24 hours a day on BBC Sounds. Just go to the dial at the top of the Sounds homepage and tap on live news where you can listen along. But first, let's get a news update from Jill McKenzie.
Has promised to make hard but fair choices with a relentless focus on the priorities of the British people. In a speech to the Labour conference in Liverpool, Rachel Reeves also insisted there be no return to austerity. She was briefly interrupted by a pro-Palestinian protester who was shouting about arms sales to Israel. Our political correspondent Alex Forsyth was watching.
I think there was a sort of dual approach here from Rachel Reeves. She wanted to maintain what she believes she has established as a reputation for fiscal credibility, being trusted with the public money, but at the same time, conscious of the fact there has been some criticism about an overly gloomy outlook, she wanted to inject a note of optimism as well.
Nurses in England have rejected the government's offer of a 5.5% pay rise for this financial year. Two-thirds of members of the Royal College of Nursing voted against the deal in a record high turnout. Lebanon's health ministry says heavy Israeli bombardment in the south of the country has killed at least 180 people and injured more than 700 others. The Israeli military says it's targeted Hezbollah positions across southern Lebanon. Our Middle East correspondent Hugo Bachega is in Beirut.
What we're seeing here today is the most intense and widespread wave of Israeli airstrikes in this conflict between Israel and Hezbollah. The fear here is that this could be the beginning of a wider Israeli offensive against Hezbollah that could perhaps include a ground offensive to try to create a buffer zone in the south and push Hezbollah away from the border.
Almost 7 in 10 post office sub-postmasters say they've had an unexplained discrepancy on the Horizon IT system since January 2020. From 1999 to 2015, more than 900 sub-postmasters were wrongly prosecuted for fraud because of issues with the software. The post office is still using an updated version of Horizon, but this YouGov survey suggests there are still issues with it. An inquiry into the post office scandal resumes today. And the Met Office has issued an amber weather warning for heavy rains in parts of central and western England. There's also a yellow weather warning covering Wales and most of the rest of England. Around a month's worth of rain has already fallen since midnight in places, and there's been flash flooding over the weekend. That's the news. Delith Lloyd has your sport.
And within the last few minutes, Everton have announced that they've reached an agreement with the Friedkin Group over the sale of the club. It will be subject to regulatory approval, including from the Premier League, the Football Association and the Financial Conduct Authority. The Friedkin Group, though, says we look forward to providing stability to the club and sharing our vision for its future, including the completion of the new Everton Stadium at Bramley Moor Docks. That news just reaching us in the last few minutes that Everton have announced they've reached an agreement with the Friedkin Group over the sale of the club. The Football Association will be taking no further action in regards to any of the incidents from yesterday's game between Arsenal and Manchester City. City striker Erling Haaland was seen throwing the ball at Gabriel's head after his side's late equaliser, and following the final whistle was caught up in an argument with Gabriel Jesus on the pitch. And Glamorgan have set Somerset 187 to win cricket's one-day cup final at Trent Bridge. Glamorgan made 186 for 7 in their innings. Somerset are currently 150 for 4 in the 18th. The final was due to be played yesterday. It was washed out, and a poor forecast today meant the innings each side were reduced to 20 overs a side. Coverage does continue right now over on Five Sports Extra.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live, the voice of the UK, Matt Chorley.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Welcome along to to a very rainy Liverpool docks. We are, well, literally right on the banks of the Mersey. And everyone is a bit damp. Here comes the sun. If only, frankly. It's incredibly wet at the Labour Party conference, where the mood is a weird mix of jubilation at being in government and horror at being in government. Yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away. Yeah, all right, Keir, I know it's turned out to be a bit harder than you thought. When I find myself in times of trouble, which is most days now, I know you want to get by with a little help from my friends. Yes, but it was what they were buying that was the problem. Can't buy me love. No, but they could buy you glasses and the clothes she wore. And it turned out she's got a ticket to Taylor Swift and the football and lots of other things as well. And then there's the question of who gets paid what, which has caused the sue me, sue you, no. Which means you need a bit of help while hoping that here in Liverpool, at least, everyone can come together right now. Right, that's probably enough of that. That's enough of that. Right, of course. Right, coming up on today's show, then, live from Liverpool. Of course, we'll be trying to find another Five Live listener in a random constituency to become an MMP, member of Matt's Parliament. We had an absolute cracker on Friday in Manchester Withington, but I think I ended up splitting it three ways because everyone seemed to have drunk in the same pub in the 1980s. Can we do better than that today? I've been having a root around in the Labour Party merch shop. Just how much does a colour your own Larry the Cat tote bag cost? That's the sort of information you can get from me today. I've been behind the wheel of a tractor to talk food security. I've been to the pub in the spirit of journalistic endeavour, watching Rachel Reeves' big speech with some real voters here in Liverpool, watching along in real time to get their reaction to what the Chancellor had to say. I've also been to a sober party too, also in the spirit of journalistic endeavour, where I caught up with the Arsenal and England legend Tony Adams, talking about his own battles with drinking addiction. Weirdly, doing the interview, sitting just in front of the white piano which John Lennon wrote Imagine on. Apparently, Tony does play the piano, but we weren't allowed to play that piano. But anyway, you can hear what happened in the interview a bit later on. And on the subject of music and sport, Lisa Nandy, the Culture Secretary, is here. How are you?
I'm really good. I've just hot-footed it over from the Chancellor's speech in the main hall, which was really energetic. People were left feeling really ambitious about the future. It's just what we needed.
Do you think she's moved the mood dial? We've gone from gloomy to quite smiley.
Look, we haven't shied away from the difficult choices that we have to make, and we know that many of those are very difficult for the country. But what the Chancellor painted today was a vision of what we will achieve if we'd set about fixing the foundations, because we promised several months ago when we were elected as a new government that we would end the Tory chaos, we would end the economic instability, and we would make Britain a really great place to invest again so that we can have good jobs in every community and we can invest in our public services. And she painted not just a vision of that today, but a plan to get us there, and that's why we're all feeling so optimistic.
It wasn't great timing at the exact moment when she was talking about settling pay disputes, getting people back to work, ending the strikes. The nurses rejected a 5.5% pay deal. What's your reaction to that?
Well, look, trade unions are there to stand up for their members, and we have to make the right decisions in the interests of the country. And we're not at all unsympathetic to the fact that the nurses have been through a really difficult decade and a half. They've had several top-down reorganisations under the Tory governments that we've had. They've had an unprecedented global pandemic, and there are millions of people on NHS waiting lists.
So do you think they deserve more than 5.5%?
We believe that they're partners in our national endeavour. If we're going to create an NHS fit for the future, they are absolutely essential, as are all the other NHS workers, whether it's the porters, the cleaners, the junior doctors, the caterers, and we're determined to partner with them.
But the junior doctors got a much bigger pay rise. So is the government's position now that you'd look to give the nurses more?
We'll get around the table, we'll talk to the nurses, but obviously we were elected to fix the foundations. We've got a £22 billion black hole this year alone. We've got to make some difficult choices, but already the Chancellor has announced an above inflation pay rise for all public sector workers, including nurses, not just because they deserve it, but because it makes good economic sense. If you put money into the pockets of working people, go straight back out into your local high street and your local economy, and that's the difference in the approach that we take compared to the Tory years of austerity where they strip that money out of communities and we saw a spiral of economic decline.
What's the difference between Tory austerity, where they cut government departments and they took benefits off people, and Labour, whatever it is that you're doing, which isn't austerity, which is cutting departmental budgets and taking winter fuel payments off people?
Well, David Cameron and George Osborne were absolutely clear in 2010 that they believed that Britain's problem was that the state had become so overgrown, in their words, I think they called it bloated, that it was crowding out public sector, private sector investment. And they made a deliberate decision to try and cut back the state. By contrast, we had a Chancellor who stood on that stage today who said, look, we're making difficult choices in order that we can start to grow the economy. And
the experience for normal people is ultimately the same. Budgets being cut, losing things they used to get. The fact that you might be doing it unhappily, and you say the Conservatives wanted to do it, the experience for real people. The winter fuel payments thing has come up again and again at this conference. Yeah. Unions aren't happy about it. I sat in a... We'll hear it on the show a bit later on. I sat with some voters watching Rachel Reeves' speech, and they just don't understand why the first thing you've done is take winter fuel payments off some of the poorest pensioners in the country.
Well, look, let me try and dispute the fact that we're hitting the poorest pensioners, because what we've done alongside that is a huge drive to up the number of poorer pensioners who are eligible for the pension credit but aren't currently receiving it. We've had a huge drive to get them onto pension credit, and we've extended that all the way till April so that they, even if they apply late, they don't have to worry about turning their heating on this winter. Through that and the pension triple lock and the extension to the Household Support Fund, we will make sure that no pensioner is worse off this winter than they were last winter. But we were elected only a few months ago promising to end the Tory chaos, create economic stability and start to grow the economy again. The Chancellor made the point today that if David Cameron and George Osborne hadn't made that ideological choice to cut back the state, if our economy had grown at the same rate as other OECD economies, we would be billions of pounds better off as a consequence. And the difference between us and them is that our measures are aimed at creating stability and growth so that everybody can benefit. And you can see it in the choices we've already made so far.
You mentioned ending Tory chaos. Some people would look at what's been happening in the Labour government over the past couple of weeks and say it certainly has the air of chaos, where the Prime Minister doesn't know who's bought his wife's dress. The Prime Minister has had more freebies than any other MP in the Houses of Parliament, whether it's tickets or clothes or whatever else. You've had arguments, Cabinet Ministers baffled by why the Chief of Staff is paid more than the Prime Minister. To some people, that looks like Labour chaos.
Well, I'm in the Cabinet, and I can tell you that the mood amongst us is very different. The number of people who've remarked that about the fact that we actually seem to like each other in Cabinet and that how easy it is now to get things done.
But I know, because I've spoken to some of your colleagues not on the radio, and they are baffled by what has happened over the past couple of weeks, why this story is run and run, why... Instead of talking about all the things that you want to talk about, the conversation has been about why the Prime Minister has taken so many freebies.
Well, look, I'm happy to talk about whatever you want to talk about, Matt. And I know that you generally reflect the concerns of the public. So yeah. I'm happy to talk about that. But one of the reasons that this is a story is because we have promised as a government to be absolutely open and transparent about what we do.
But people aren't cross that you've been transparent. They're cross that... government ministers, your colleagues, have gone on TV and radio and said the Prime Minister has to have other people buy his clothes because he can't afford them. And he earns several times what the average salary is. Yeah. It sounds baffling and out of touch.
Well, look, it's really important to us and to me that people don't think that we live completely different lives.
It's notable.
From the people
you've declared very, very little on your Register of Members' interests.
Well, that's
by
not,
contrast.
That's not because I'm hiding anything. That's
no, yeah, because you buy your own clothes.
Well, I do buy my own clothes, but also, you know, over the last few months, I've been the Culture, Media and Sports Secretary. I've been going to events. I went to the Paralympics over the summer. I went to the Edinburgh Military Tattoo. It's really important to me to be at the Paralympics, to cheer on our team, but also to meet some of the incredible Paralympians who are running a campaign.
It's part of your job.
To end the scandal of only one in four kids with disabilities being able to access PE in our country. I wouldn't have known anything about that campaign if I hadn't been there. It's now seared on my memory and we're determined to do something about it. And I have declared that, and that will be published by the Cabinet Office. But, you know, some people would say that I shouldn't be taking a trip like that. And that's the point, isn't it? Is that these are judgments that we have to make, and people are entitled to judge us about whether we've done the right thing or not. And that's why we declare all of this.
When there's a news story in the paper today, Angela Rayner's department's hired a photographer. When David Cameron hired a photographer, you said it was outrageous at a time when people are losing their jobs and homes. Why is it different now?
Well, I don't know the details of Angela Rayner's photographer. I think there are people who work for the government who are hired as photographers for the government. But that's not what David Cameron did. David Cameron hired a personal photographer at taxpayers' expense to follow him around and produce PR shots. I think it's important
I don't understand what the difference is.
Well, because he brought in his own private photographer to take those
pictures.
So it
was a problem with the person rather than the taxpayer.
It was an additional cost to the taxpayer at a time when he was very deliberately going out to cut every bit of the state back. He was trying to reduce the civil service headcount. He was stripping jobs out of communities like mine as a consequence. And he was cutting back every department, which was having appalling consequences for people. You can't, on the one hand, say
you're cutting back departments now. You're having cuts in your department. Is Rachel Reeves told you to find money?
We're all aware of the economic circumstances that we find ourselves in, but David Cameron cannot go around saying that the state is too bloated while increasing the size of the state when it benefits him.
It was outrageous that at a time of austerity he hired a photographer on the taxpayer. Today there's a story in the paper that Angela Rayner's department has hired a photographer on the taxpayer. My point is, you're trying to create this one rule for one and one rule for the other. It's almost identical.
No, look, I don't believe it is. And the reason that I don't is just simply this, that it was an ideological choice to cut back the state under David Cameron and George Osborne. They constantly talked about the bloated state, but they would increase that spending when it personally benefited them. I think that's hypocritical. I don't think it's okay.
Because I know there's nothing more annoying than if you're cabinet minister, you go into an interview and you talk about everything other than your own brief.
Can't we talk about sport for a change?
Let's talk about sport. Let's talk about football.
Okay.
And the football regulator. What difference will it make to football fans listening to Five Live right now if this regulator happens?
Well, we've had a series of clubs that have fallen over or come close to it. My own Wigan Athletic is a case in point, but you know the worst example is probably Bury FC, where the fans lost the lot and had to rebuild from scratch. We think that's completely unsustainable. There's cross-party support for taking action. What the bill does is introduce a regulator with a system that incentivises football to come together and resolve these problems, to make sure that the clubs in the Championship are financially sustainable, to make sure that the Premier League can continue to thrive, to make sure that money flows through to the grassroots. And if they can't, it gives the regulator powers to intervene. But the key thing is that government doesn't want to be involved in this. We want football to come to its own view, and we're here to introduce legislation to make it possible and make it much more likely that they do that.
There is some concern. I know UEFA wrote to you saying that if the regulator has to take account of the government's foreign and trade policy objectives, it could contravene their rules that football shouldn't be regulated in that way, and ultimately could lead to England being barred from taking part in Euro 2028, which we're co-hosting with Ireland. Is that realistic?
No, it's absolute nonsense. And actually, I've spoken to UEFA. They don't have any concerns about the football governance bill, which we announced in the King's Speech. Neither does the FA. And broadly speaking, before the election, and credit where credit's due, this started life as a Conservative bill led by Tracy Crouch, who did a fan-led review and has been enormously helpful to me. Where we got to before the election was a system that broadly everyone could live with, that struck the right balance, that isn't heavy-handed, but will provide protections for fans against poor ownership, against financial decisions that are financially unsustainable, and mean that fans across the country who currently are lying awake at night wondering if the clubs that mean so much to them are going to be able to survive, that we take that worry away from them and we make sure that the football system is fit for the future.
I don't know if you might not have been across this because you were in the listen to Rachel's speech. Everton have just agreed a sale in the last hour or
okay.
so. If this what impact would a new regulator have had on what's already been a very long, drawn-out process? Would it have delayed it further?
No, it wouldn't have delayed it further, but it does mean that we're toughening up the system to make sure that people who are poor owners, unfit owners, can't become football club owners. That's really important because these football clubs, they're really important to the local economy in towns like mine, but they're part of our civic inheritance. The chair of my supporters trust went as a season ticket holder with her dad when she was little. She now takes her kids. We hand these things down through generations and they mean so much to people that we're determined to protect them. I was actually at the new Everton stadium that they're building here in Liverpool just yesterday and had the tip off that there may be a sale agreed. I think Andy Burnham was down there, who is a huge Evertonian, as you know,
yeah.
and was absolutely delighted that they might now get moving and move on to the next chapter.
At the risk of looping back to what we were talking about earlier, is there a conflict of interest between you trying to regulate the Premier League and the Prime Minister and others taking lots of free tickets from the Premier League, whether it's tickets at Arsenal, tickets at Tottenham, Taylor Swift tickets courtesy of the Premier League? If it was any other industry, if it was an airline or if it was a bank, if you were regulating the banks and you were taking loads of freebies from banks, that would look like a conflict of interest.
Look, the Prime Minister's a huge Arsenal supporter. He talks about it a lot, often to me. And he's gone all his life. He's a season ticket holder. And he's never made any secret of that at all. It would be...
But some of the big clubs are not as keen on the regulator as you are.
Well, that's right. But the Prime Minister... personally, before I was involved, I was doing a different brief in opposition, made a choice to put the Football Governance Bill into our manifesto. He made a choice that we should announce that in the King's Speech. We're not delaying in moving forwards with that. I think he's taken exactly the right decision. We want to see the Premier League thrive, but we know that the current system is unsustainable for many championship clubs, and we're determined to take action to change that.
The other thing that I know you sort of landed on your desk a couple of weeks ago, not long in the job, was this question of music tickets, most notably Oasis tickets. But that's probably the biggest example of a wider spread problem, whether it's touts, the access that people have to try to get, you know, particularly through Ticketmaster, because they're such a dominant force. What realistically can you do with that? Are you ready? Rachel Reeves was talking about being a more muscular interventionist government. Are you ready to intervene in this sector?
We certainly are, and we've announced a consultation. Myself and Johnny Reynolds, the new business secretary, announced a consultation that will run over this autumn. The question for us is not whether you reform the system to put fans back at the heart. It's how you reform the system to put fans back at the
heart. And what would that mean? Could it be price caps?
Well, the sort of things that we're looking at, for example, is clamping down on secondary ticket touting, so where companies can buy up huge numbers of tickets and then sell them at vastly inflated rip-off prices to fans, only those fans, of course, who can afford them. We're also looking at what happened with Oasis this time round, where you've got a situation where a lot of people, they got on the phone, they got in that big queue, they finally got to the front of the queue and they found that the ticket price had increased by hundreds of pounds and they couldn't actually afford to buy them. That most of those people, unlike the systems that we have for things like Uber and flights, they didn't know that that's how the system works. And so we're looking at the transparency yeah. around those arrangements as well.
Lisa, it's really good to speak to you. You're being pulled away from us because I know you're very busy. Lisa Nady, Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
On Five Live today. Do let us know what you think about any of our conversation at 08085 909 693 on the WhatsApp. Do get in touch in the... you can text 850058 or 08085 909 693. Somebody's just texted in saying Lisa Nansen sounds almost embarrassed to admit she buys her own clothes. That's where we are now in politics, though. Very good. It's Matt Chorley coming to you live from Liverpool at the Labour Party conference. And anyone who had a wander around the conference sort of exhibition stands, you can tell a party's in government, you can tell a party's on the up. Well, it's absolutely jam-packed with businesses and charities and lobbyists with their corporate stands, desperate to bend the ear of MPs and ministers and sometimes journalists, including a great big tractor. Now, as an expert, who I've learnt to drive on a tractor, as we discussed a week or so ago on the show, it's a great big red tractor, and it's been brought here by the National Farmers Union, the NFU. So before we came on air, I went to have a look. Hello. Can I talk to you about why you've got a massive tractor?
Well, why wouldn't you bring a massive tractor to the Labour
Party? Actually, it's not that big, is it? That's a small tractor by
It's fairly small, but I mean, Alid will probably be... Alid is our NFU company president, and he will have many more tractors than I do.
Do remember it's red, isn't it?
It's a red tractor, because of the Labour Party.
Well, obviously.
Will you have a blue one next week?
I'm not sure, but...
Well, don't go making those sorts of promises now.
No, but this one fits in very easily onto the stand as But it just shows, really, the importance of everything that's involved in food production all the way through.
And is that the message you're trying to land here at Coffers?
Well, it's the critical nature of food supply. I think, you know, Labour Party have embedded food security within a manifesto. I think we need to, develop that thinking. So we're here, we're listening... our farmers are more than prepared to be involved, but food security is a very complex issue.
What does that look like? Is it setting a level of self-sufficiency or targets for food production? What does the ambition for food security mean in practice?
Well, food security means many, many things. I think when they consider population growth and the resources available to grow that food, it's quite critical. Now, at the end of it, when you boil down to the bare limits, is the farmer confidence. Mm. And that's what the critical nature is. And we need to cater for that farmer confidence all the way through.
And that's because... if you're going to put crops in, you need to know there's going to be a market for them.
Well, yes, of course. And you need to make sure that retail respects that the supply chain delivers the value back to the primary producers. We need policies that can enable farmers to be involved in energy generation as well, all the way through. Quite a number of issues that we need to be seeing.
Yeah. And does it feel like this new Labour government is listening?
Well, I can tell you what's happening in Wales, okay? Okay, so quite a number of things are ongoing in Wales. And obviously we've had a Labour government in Wales for many, many years. The design of the new policy has seen a lot of aggravation. But we're in a position at the moment, I would say, there's more collaboration with policymakers all the way through.
It's really good to see you.
You probably need to speak to Tom, because in English perspective,
yes.
I think you need to bring the...
Tom Blanchard, President of the NFU, good to see you as well. So that's the picture in Wales. What's the picture in England? Do you feel like the new Labour government is listening to your concerns?
We've had great access to the team within DEFRA. I think we can't fault them on that since the election.
You've seen them a lot, but are they listening?
Well, this is the critical thing. We now need actions, don't we? I mean, we talked about farmer confidence there. But what we need are policies that are going to enable our members to invest in food production today. That guarantees food security for the next generation. And if we're not making those investments, then we're living off investments of the past. So we need the government to announce the agricultural budget, an enhanced budget that can deliver for food production, that can deliver for those environmental targets. And at the moment, we've got a lot of listening, but action's got to come very soon.
And let's talk about, give me some examples of the sort of food that Five Live listeners would expect to be able to buy in the shops. Where is there a problem around investment and confidence?
So if you look at the food that's grown in our glasshouses, the vegetables, things like peppers, tomatoes, we're only about 20% self-sufficient in tomatoes. We could grow much more of them. Look at things like potatoes. We've seen a dramatic downward trend in the amount of potatoes produced just because of the risk profile, not enough rewards coming back to our farming members. We're at the lowest livestock levels in this country for a couple of decades. It continues to fall. Now, these are things that eventually will impact the availability on the shelf.
So what could be done about that? What is it the role of the government? Is it about supermarkets and retailers paying British farmers more? Is that the role of the government, or is it the role of the supermarkets?
Do you know what? We would like to make sure we're competing on a level playing field, and all too often we're driving our standards higher. At the moment, if you look at our chicken production, we've got some of the highest standards in Europe, but we're making sure they're going even higher still, and yet we're going to be importing chicken that's not produced to those same standards. It's simply not acceptable. So we need to be competing on a level playing field. They've committed to that within their manifesto, only importing food produced to the highest animal health and welfare standards. We would love to see them deliver on that commitment and stand here ready to help them develop that ambition.
But at the time of a cost of living crisis, and people have seen the price of everything go up, will that ultimately mean higher prices? Is the price of that shoppers have to pay more for their food?
I think we've got to decide whether we want a resilient food system in this country. We've seen the global shocks in terms of climate change, in terms of the geopolitical situation globally. We can build a resilient food system here, but our members have got to get fair prices. We don't set the price, it's retailers that set the price, but we've got to make sure that our members can invest in food production today to give food security tomorrow.
Just talk me through what you've got all around us. We've got some bread. That's not real bread, is it? That's plastic. Why have you got plastic bread? That's terrible. The NFU have got plastic bread.
Well, we're not expecting you to eat it, Matt. Do you want to eat it? Look, we've got some wheat. We've got a tractor. We've got some oats. We've got some lovely wildflowers because farmers can deliver all of this. What else have we got here? Some oats. Look, so we grow
real oats.
Real oats. Sugar. We know from our sugar.
They're not real eggs either.
Apple juice. You like a bit of apple juice?
Is it not cider?
No, it
would be much better.
It would be cider if it's after midday, but it's a bit early for that.
That's very nice apple juice. They're not real eggs. Why aren't they real eggs?
It is a real tractor.
Is it?
Yeah, well,
can I go on the tractor?
Yeah, Matt can definitely go on the tractor. You've got to go around the other side, Matt. So
I mentioned this on the show the other day. I learned to drive in a tractor, like all good people in the countryside. Did you learn to drive on a tractor?
I did, yeah. I learned on a little grey Fergie.
Yeah, right, here we go. Actually, it was quite a rickety old tractor that I learned to drive. This is quite small for a tractor, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this is probably 55 horsepower looking at it. So it's a relatively small tractor, be used on a livestock farm or in an orchard. That sort of thing. You're probably still looking at, if I was guessing, £45,000 to £50,000 or something like that. You know, significant investment required, even for these small bits of machinery. And that's where we need these realistic returns from the marketplace.
Well, I should probably be careful tooting the horn. I'll get told off. Tom, it's really good to see you. Thank you for talking me through all of your fake bread, but this is a very real tractor. There we are, me mucking about on a tractor. Now, it's that time for us to get out the big money balls. Yes, every day I'm trying to find a Five Live listener in every constituency of the country. We will randomly generate a three-digit number which corresponds with an alphabetical list of constituencies. Sam Lister from the Daily Express is here, actually to give us her hard-nosed analysis of the Labour Party conference, which we'll do in a moment. You've done this before, haven't you?
I have, yeah.
Go on,
we had a very low number last time.
Right. Oh, well, here we go.
To go a bit further into the country.
So you, in the blue bag, have a rummage in the blue bag and pull out a numbered ball. Two. I've also got two.
Oh.
So it's 2-2. You can do the last one.
I feel very honoured. Right, the drama, the tension is mounting.
2-2. You see where it's got 9 written on it?
Oh,
it's
no.
A 9.
It's a 9.
It's 2-2-9. It's Forest of Dean.
Oh.
Forest of Dean.
Wasn't
is that
Mark Harper
country?
Yeah, Mark Harper.
So, what is your connection to the Forest of Dean? Are you in the Forest of Dean?
I don't think Mark Harper is anymore, is he?
No, did he? Yeah, he lost his seat.
I think so.
He did, didn't he?
We ought to check that.
Yeah.
Because you were not live on air.
We ought to know that. Are you in the Forest of Dean? Have you been there? Did you drive through it once? Did you get married or engaged? Oh, it was Adam Fleming off of the newscaster. Oh, give us away. What is your best claim to the Forest of Dean? You can come on before the end of the show. Tell us your claim to the Forest of Dean. And whoever's got the best claim between now and 4 o'clock will win a certificate and a rosette in Five Live colours. So, if you want to get in touch, you know what to do. Lindsay Hoyle's got the details.
Call us at 08085909693 or text 85058. Email Chorley at bbc.co.uk.
There we are. Matt Bishop is the new Labour MP in the Forest of Dean. That's
well, there we go. Other people, every day's a school day.
Other people with access to Google have got that. Right, up next, Sam Lister will be joined by Pippa Crowe from The Guardian to take a look at what's really going on behind the scenes here at Labour Party Conference after we get a news update from Jill McKenzie.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, says she'll make hard but fair economic choices, but there'll be no return to austerity in the autumn budget. Speaking to the Labour Party conference, she also defended the decision to means test the winter fuel payment. Nurses in England have rejected the government's offer of a 5.5% pay rise. The Royal College of Nursing says two-thirds voted against it. Lebanon's health ministry says an intense Israeli bombardment has killed at least 180 people and injured more than 700. It's the deadliest day in nearly a year of conflict across Israel's northern border. And the Environment Agency says flooding is expected in 20 locations across central England today after heavy rain. There are also 75 alerts in place across England and Wales, meaning flooding is possible. That's the news. Delith Lloyd has your sport.
Within the last half an hour, Everton have announced that they've reached an agreement with the Friedkin Group over the sale of the club. It will be subject to Premier League approval. The Friedkin Group say, "We look forward to providing stability to the club and sharing our vision for its future, including the completion of the new Everton Stadium at Bramley Moor Dock." Dan Friedkin, who also owns Serie A side Roma, had previously agreed a deal in principle to purchase current owner Mashiri's 94% stake in June. Talks were then called off in July after the two parties failed to finalise an agreement, but a deal has now been agreed and signed. The Football Association will be taking no further action in regards to any of the incidents from yesterday's game between Arsenal and Manchester City. City striker Erling Haaland was seen throwing the ball at Gabriel's head after his side's late equaliser and after the final whistle was caught up in an argument with Gabriel Jesus on the pitch. The match was full of incident, not least Arsenal forward Leandro Trossard being sent off after being shown a yellow card for kicking the ball away at the end of the first half. The former Premier League referee and ex-head of referees Keith Hackett has told us he should have known better.
Michael saw that as kicking the ball away and as such issued that second yellow. It seemed harsh. What worries me a little bit is that when players are on a yellow card, their behaviour, they need to take a bit more care either with their challenges or with their any other action, and they just need a bit of common sense.
In cricket's one-day cup final, Glamorgan have beaten Somerset by 15 runs at Trent Bridge. Kevin Howells was watching.
Setting 187 for Somerset to chase, reduced to 20 overs per side on a reserve day here at Trent Bridge, and so surreal. There are some spectators, but not that many in the ground today, and such low cloud around the floodlights on. But for Glamorgan, lifting the one-day cup for a second time in 4 years, they've just done so just down the far end of the ground as well. Of course, for Somerset, just a couple of weeks ago, they're on possible course for a treble. They've ended up without a trophy this season, so disappointment for them. A few standout moments today. Player of the match, Sam Northey. 63 not out of 49 balls. Tim van der Gooten, late smash and grab, 26 off 9. One disastrous over from Casey Aldridge, went for 29 runs. And the highlight really for Somerset, their captain Sean Dixon looking so good. 44 of just 20 deliveries, reverse whipping Andy Gorman. He was out in the 18th over. Shame for Somerset, he should have batted maybe a little bit higher. But Glamorgan, a one-day cup champions.
Kevin, great to hear. Well done, Glamorgan. That's the latest from BBC Sport. And remember, you can listen at any time through your smart speaker by saying play BBC Sports News.
I'm Kim Cattrall, and I want to tell you about my new podcast, a new audio drama telling the history of the CIA from the inside out.
The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked.
He's got to convince Congress to give him an open checkbook now.
America has suffered its worst domestic attack of the 20th century at Pearl Harbor.
How do we make contact with the NKGB?
Central Intelligence, starring me, Kim Cattrall, Ed Harris, and Johnny Flynn.
There's $50,000 in it for you if you say yes.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
BBC Radio 5 Live, the voice of the UK.
On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker
to play BBC Radio 5 Live.
Matt Shawley.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Very good afternoon. It's Matt Shawley live from Liverpool. I was going to say sunny. It's not sunny. It's still quite wet and miserable outside. But a little bit later than we normally do on a Monday. It's nice to just chew over what's going on in the news with two of our favourite journalists. With some typewriter-based theme music, I am joined by Pippa Creer, with the political editor of The Guardian. Hello, Pippa.
Hello,
welcome back.
It's
nice you're both returnees.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Sam Lister, political editor of the Express.
Hello.
Are you, apart from being damp, Sam, are you, sum up the overall mood of the conference?
Oh, I think
it's a tedious, cliched opening question.
It's a conference of two very different moods. The young party members are absolutely cock-a-hoop. They're having the absolute time of their life. They're going to all the parties. The parties are all rammed. They're absolutely loving it. But I think for the ministers and the special advisers, they are loving it less. They're getting grilled on the media round. They're getting embarrassed about who bought the clothes. They're all briefing against each other already, even to papers like mine, you know, not traditionally friendly papers. So, yeah, I think it's very, very different. It, you know, if you are a member, you're happy. If you're a minister, you're less so.
Yeah, Pip, I said at the start of the show that they are both jubilant at being in government and horrified about being in government. That seems to be the two sort of mindsets they find themselves in.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think if you're talking about the politicians, I wouldn't say they're quite jubilant because they recognise that, obviously, they've had to recognise very quickly that government is really hard work. And horrified, yeah, I mean, I guess there's moments where they wish they could sort of sneak away into the relative oblivion that comes with being in opposition, but they can't, obviously. They're, you know, they're accountable now. They've got to be accountable. They can't duck away when we sort of come at them with questions about all sorts of stuff we want to know about. But yeah, there's definitely mixed feelings, absolutely.
Is it, what do you think happened? Because there was a point where, I mean, the whole point of bringing in Sue Gray was because she knew how government worked. This was going to be the most ready incoming government ever. Yeah. And now they're sort of playing, oh, it's all very complicated and difficult. We've only just started. Of course, there's going to be teething trouble. And what happened? Was that, did they actually think that they were the most prepared government ever?
I think the election took them by surprise, despite everything that was said.
That's
at the time.
The
I think they thought that it could be, they thought it was more likely to be an autumn election. So they did have some plans in place, and that was obviously Sue Gray's job. She knows how the government works. But I think when they, you know, when they came in, it wasn't just sort of the realities of having to deal with, I mean, they say a £22 billion in year black hole, or the sort of all the big decisions that have to, that, you know, react to events. There's obviously the riots over the summer, it's all those sorts of things. There's also been, I think it's taken them time to sort of settle into the roles at Downing Street, and quite evidently from the last few weeks, we can see that it's not necessarily the happiest of ships, that there's different power bases developing.
I mean, go on then, talk us through. This is good. This is good inside intel. Where are the power bases?
So everyone talks about Morgan McSweeney, who's Keir Starmer's top political aide, and Sue Gray, who is, of course, their civil service background chief of staff, being at loggerheads. Now, I'm told that they, the individuals themselves, are not actually loggerheads. They've got a perfectly functioning relationship. May not be the best of pals, but they have different areas of responsibility and they kind of get on with it. The difficulties are all the people around them who see themselves as their backers, their allies, their friends, and are motivated for, actually, I think, quite a wide range of reasons to have a go, mostly at Sue Gray. And they include people in the civil service who she worked with before, who either aren't too happy about the way she handled the Partygate report, or indeed the fact that when she left the civil service and came to be Labour's chief of staff in opposition. They include some of the political side who think that she's they describe her as sort of being a block on progress, that sort of, you know, piles of documents sitting on her desk and they can't get in to see Starmer. And they also include those that are, frankly, a bit peed off because their salaries are lower than Tory spads were when they came into government, and she, as we know, has a standard civil service salary, which is three or four grand higher than the Prime Minister, which seems remarkable. They didn't spot the pro optics of that. So there's all these different reasons for this. The problem is that it looks like Starmer hasn't got a grip, and it looks like the Downing Street operation, and he said, I'm in control.
Once you're saying, like, I'm completely in control.
It's a problem, right, isn't it? Somebody needs to bang some heads together or point somebody to a new post or do something, but it's a distraction. They don't want to be talking about what's going on Downing Street, particularly when they said, we are not going to be a government of chaos. That was the last slot. We're going to be united and just get on with the job. They want to get on with the job, and the Cabinet are deeply frustrated by all what they regard as the distractions of what's going on in Number 10.
Go on, Sam.
No, I was just going to say, do you know, I think there is a fundamental problem at the heart of this government, and there is a reason why we have politicians and civil servants. And the whole thing was, oh, Sue Gray's been brought in, she's a civil servant, she understands how things are working, how to get things done in government. You know, we don't let civil servants run the country without politicians for a reason, because if you leave everything to civil servants, they look at things on a sheet of paper and they work out, you know, this would be the best option, blah, blah, blah. And then you end up with things like the winter fuel cuts row, which is inherently political, because on paper it might look like a really sensible thing to do. In practice, it's caused fury, and anyone with political instincts would have seen that a mile off. And because you've got Keir Starmer, who is technocratic, and you've got Sue Gray, who is a civil servant, these people did not spot this absolutely massive row coming down the tracks, because, and a special advisor said to me yesterday, we think it was one of those Treasury things, a bit like the pasty tax from Days Gone Old, where the Treasury bring out
this... Point at me when you mention pasties.
I just remember endless questions about the pasty tax box in brief.
Because I was working for the West of Wadding News, and obviously the pasty industry.
With the pasty,
the pasty industry was very important to the good people of Cornwall.
And rightly so. And that's why, you know, you were a regional reporter and you were championing that. And anybody with an ounce of common sense would have seen that coming a mile and off. Obviously, because the Treasury dusts off all these things. Here we are, Chancellor. Here are all these brilliant things you can easily do to save some money. And they don't look at it politically. And that is a big problem.
I think it's really interesting. Sam's absolutely right. And I think part of it is the way that Starmer views the world. And he's thinking about the next 5 years, the long-term plan, how he can transform the country. He doesn't want to be buffeted by the sort of events that we've had over the last couple of weeks. I guess he sees them almost as like a distraction from the plan and from getting on with it. The problem is if you ignore them completely, I mean, obviously the comms operation should be responding to every single line and development on this, but if you let it sort of continue, and we saw this actually during the election campaign when he made those comments on Gaza on LBC, it went on for like 9 or 10 days. It's a similar thing here. It's going on for 9 or 10 days when it could have been closed down on day one, partly because the tone at the top is actually, you know, what, these things are relevant, they don't really matter. But, and we didn't break any rules, but even if they didn't break any rules, which it looks like they didn't, technically the things by the book, that's not what the public actually is bothered about. They're bothered about whether it passes the smell test, the sniff test, how it feels, the optics of it. And people think that, you know, this is a government that came in saying we're going to be whiter than white, that held the Tories to very close, high account when it came to standards, coming in and looking to the public, regardless of whether the rules have actually been breached or not. It sort of feels a bit sort of uncomfortable.
There does feel like there's a sort of, and I know this from having spoken to people in Number 10, there's this sort of, and it is, I've been around long enough, this happens a lot when new people go into Number 10. They're like, we're not here to respond to every story. We're not here to feed the media beast. We think this is trivial and you need to move on. And they discover that the media doesn't behave in that way. And just saying we're not bothered by this, we don't think we've done anything wrong, doesn't make the story go away. And so you then had that situation last week where instead of Keir Starmer doing a pointless visit where he just does a clip and draws a line under it, they said nothing about freebies until he did a whole day of regional political editor interviews where every single one of them, 15, 20 people, asked him the same
and then it still took
question.
Him 24 hours to say we're not going to take any more clothes.
Yeah, and so it sort of keeps coming back. But on the subject of clothes, let's have a little listen to a clip of, this is Rachel Reeves speaking this morning, talking about her own clothes, and this is on the Today programme, wasn't it? And she was asked about the clothes that she was wearing. Let's take a listen.
Did you pay for the suit that you're wearing this morning?
I did. The suit is from Hobbs, and I bought it, and I will be wearing it for my conference speech this afternoon.
Can you educate me in the world of Hobbs, ladies?
I was really struck by that because it's a very careful choice. It's a very middle-of-the-road, but smart brand. So it's not going to ruffle any feathers. She's not spending huge amounts.
So it's a bit higher than sort of M&S?
It's higher than M&S. But it's not like a fancy schmancy.
Yeah.
It's not the M&M favoured brand fancy schmancy that Angela Rayner's been wearing, for example, which is another level up again. So it's kind of very middle of the road, very safe, very traditional, good quality. You're going to look smart, but you're not going to set the world on fire.
It does. It's basically, over the course of the conference so far, I've spoken to maybe about a dozen cabinet ministers. And you kind of feel as a journalist, because this is a story you need to either make a joke or indeed make a comment, find out what they're wearing. So I know more about cabinet ministers' clothes now. My favourite story is, I hope she doesn't mind me saying, it was Yvette Cooper, the Home Secretary, who turned up to coffee we had wearing a very, you know, very nice, smart sort of linen blazer. And I obviously made a joke with, oh, you know, where's that from? And, you know, how much did it cost? And she said, well, actually, I was, you know, where you donated it. She said, yes, well, I was given it, but I was given it by my mum, who wore it to my wedding and then decided to pass it on to me. Now, Yvette Cooper and Ed Balls got married, I don't know, like 20 years
ago? A long time ago. They've got grown-up
so
children.
I think she passes the test on you know, frugal
well, hope,
approach
I
to
I hope she declared that second-hand jacket.
From her mum, for
she
her
might
wedding.
She wearing a hair shirt. I mean,
just explain to people who don't know, when you're talking about, like, so obviously people think party conferences, it's the speeches on the stage, and there's a big speech each day, and today was Rachel Reeves, tomorrow was Keir Starmer. What are the cabinet ministers doing the rest of the time with people like you?
Well, I think
the journalist bit of it is probably a very small bit of it. They are sort of meeting all sorts of other, you know, their constituency associations and delegates, and probably there's a few sort of, you know, business. There's a business day today, I think, actually, where businesses have to spend £3,000 to be here. A whole load of stakeholders from charities to, you know, third sector and beyond, and an international presence as well. Actually, I've seen quite a few diplomats floating around.
Yes.
But in terms of the journalists, we kind of view it, I guess, as like almost like speed dating. Although, I mean, that's a bit of rubbish speed dating, isn't it? Going from one cabinet minister to the next. It feels a bit odd because here we are in Liverpool. Most of us work within about a square mile of each other in London. But nevertheless, it's a very good way to see lots of politicians in a very short space of time. Part of our job is obviously maintaining relationships with them, so we can sort of, you know, find out properly what's going on. Although sometimes it does feel, you know, it's a bit much. Like, I mean, I've not eaten anything today, apart from I was just saying to Sam before we came on air, for my lunch today, I had a pot of porridge and a packet of Skittles.
Porridge for lunch?
It's the only thing I could find to eat, because the queues around here are massive.
Horrendous.
You can't go anywhere. So, yeah, so porridge. I'm a Scottish, I'll eat porridge anytime.
I'm glad you said that. However, if I'd said that, I would be cancelled.
with a packet of Skittles as well, though, which maybe is not quite as healthy as you might.
One of
my
five a day.
One of my five a day, at least in terms of the colour of them. So, yeah, so it's very frenetic. And in between all that, we need to kind of, like, write stories, find out what's going on, try and get behind the scenes as what's actually happening, rather than, you know, accepting as read everything we're told from the podium when the politicians come and speak to us.
So what have you been surviving on, Sam?
Oh, well, I just queued outside for half an hour in the rain for a very kind of... It was actually not bad, a little sandwich, but, you know, it all feels a bit miserable. But, you know, I'm not expecting anybody out there listening to feel sorry for us. I mean, it's not a bad way to earn a living, I'm not going to lie. But I think on the meeting with cabinet ministers and so on, it's a good chance to bring junior members of your team in as well, for them to meet more senior people than they would ordinarily be doing in Westminster. And also to bring in editors and so on. They get to actually, you know, find out what the politicians really think behind the scenes. So it's quite a good opportunity on that front. But we also have briefings, don't we, by special advisers, and that's when we throw all the questions at them and, you know, say, you know, why are you cutting winter fuel? It's insane. And then they give us their, you know, justification for why they're doing that.
Well, in fact, I think we could listen to Rachel Reeves' justification from her speech today talking about winter fuel, because I was quite struck. We'll hear later on what the voters who are watching along with us thought of it. So this is Rachel Reeves speaking just a bit earlier.
I know that not everyone in this hall or in the country will agree with every decision that I make. But I will not duck those decisions. Not for political expediency, not for personal advantage. Faced with that £22 billion black hole that the Conservatives left this year, and with a triple lock ensuring that the state pension will rise by an estimated £1,700 over the course of this Parliament, I judged it the right decision in the circumstances that we inherited.
So that's Rachel Rees with her justification. Meanwhile, you've got a lot of unions putting forward a motion to be voted on, because they still do that at Labour conference. The non-binding conference vote on the government's winter fuel cuts has been pushed back to the end of the day on Wednesday, just as they're dismantling the party conference. But Mick Whelan, who's the General Secretary of ASLEF, says he opposes the cut.
Well, I can, in all honesty, go back and face my retired members section, having voted for that. So I think many unions are in the same place. We ran on a platform of anti-austerity. We ran on a platform that there were 14 million people in poverty, 1 million people in destitution, and we were the party to change that. I know it's going to take a long time to reverse what's happened in the past, but I do believe an awful lot of people will support opposing this.
I mean, that's the other element of this conference, isn't it, Pippi? You've got the unions who pay for an awful lot of what the Labour Party does.
Well, yes, they do. Although I think Labour would argue currently there's more money, they've had more money from donors. Maybe actually they don't want to argue that currently, given the decisions.
Anyway,
I do think this is actually, I think the winter fuel payment route is really interesting. For all we may talk about, you know, freebies, holidays, free clothes, donor, you know, issues in number 10, all the rest of it. This is the single issue, I think, since they took power, which has the potential to cause them really serious problems. And I think the fact, I'm sure Sam will have her view, but I do think the fact that, like, I hope I'm not taking words out of your mouth, that, you know, she and her readers
Oisin, on behalf of her readers, has been incredibly critical about it. The unions at the opposite end of the political spectrum are incredibly critical about it. And there's a lot of people out there, a couple of million people who are sort of, you know, are not the wealthy pensioners that can manage without it, but sort of just above the threshold who are going to be worse off as a result, as fuel bills are going up. And as, unfortunately, every winter, it's really tricky for a lot of people to be able to afford their fuel bills. Some of them end up in hospital, some of them even die. And I think in terms of how it will look, these things unfortunately happen every year, but people turn around and directly blame the government for them. And I think it's got the potential to be a really serious problem for them that goes way beyond. Because it was a choice. I'm not saying that any other options they'd have gone for would necessarily be easier. We don't know what they were choosing between. But it was their decision to try and to fill 1.5 billion worth of that 22 billion black hole by doing the winter fuel cuts. And I think it might come back to haunt them.
I think the only reason the donor row scandal has taken off is because of the winter fuel cuts. If you took the winter fuel cuts row out of this, and there was this bit of a hoo-ha about who paid for various people's clothing, I don't think it would have caused the anger it has. It strikes home because people look and say, why can the Prime Minister on such a big salary, why can he not on such a big salary, combined with his wife, £200,000, we believe, he's been on a big salary for a long, long time, why can he not afford to pay for his clothes and his wife's clothes? And if you cannot manage your own salary when you're on such a huge amount, how can you expect pensioners on £13,000 to lose up to £300 in one go? And I think that's why it hits home.
Yeah, it's also the handling of it as well. And pretty much every cabinet minister I've spoken to has said privately that they think it could be handled better. And one of the main things is about sort of the presentation at the time. When Rachel Reeves made the announcement back in January, they waited about 6 weeks before they sort of announced any mitigations, the expansion of the household support fund, the sort of the tying of the linking of pension credit and housing benefit, the campaign to get more people onto pension credit. And crucially, they didn't seem to say anything at the time about the pension triple lock and the fact that people have been £900 better off this year and £400 better off next year, so net might be okay. And it just strikes me as a really weird, if you're going to make a really difficult announcement like that, why don't you not announce some mitigations and do it in the context
but
of sort of the,
don't
what you're
announce,
doing?
Don't announce overall. At the same time that you're going to give train drivers a massive pay hike when train drivers are already on a lot of money.
Maybe that goes back to the point you were making about the sort of the technocratic.
Yeah.
You know, the reason they did that was because they were spending a lot of money and they wanted to show that they were balancing the books.
Yeah.
And so the sort of the accountant makes sense.
Yeah.
You're paying out for the train drivers and the other public sectors. So to show that they were going to take tough decisions to balance the books, they announced this thing without thinking about the optics and the or opticians, as it turns out.
But also, like, that is being human instead of being a technocrat, and that is the bit that's missing in all of this, and that goes to the heart of it all.
It'll be fascinating. And obviously we've got another month yet before the budget actually comes around to see what they do about it. Ben has been in touch with the best suggestion so far on the clothing issue. It says, hi, Matt. Regarding the clothing scandal, I strongly believe that all government officials and MPs should all be issued with party-branded overalls so to be quickly identified and judged accordingly.
Oh, I love this.
There's more. If that particular official performs well, they're issued with chevrons on their arms until he or she becomes Prime Minister. If they perform badly, they are forced to wear leather dungarees.
This is like a weird mixture of like the Politburo and the Girl Guides, isn't it? I mean,
sounds good to me.
It's worth a go. There's something nice about wearing a uniform. You don't have to worry about what to wear.
There'll be no take all the fuss out of it. Angela Rayne and Rachel Reeves, they don't have to worry about how they're looking anymore.
Well, I'm glad we sorted that out. Well done, Ben. Lovely to see you both. I imagine you've got a bit of a busy afternoon.
We do,
non-stop wall-to-wall coffees.
Yes, exactly. More Skittles and porridge.
Isn't it time for wine?
What are you living on? Did I ask you that a minute ago?
Yes, we've already done the food.
What did you say?
It was a very sad sandwich.
Oh, very sad sandwich.
I had a very sad sandwich.
I'm 90% fry-ups and sad sandwiches. That's my entire... Sam Minister from The Express, Pippa Crowe from The Guardian. Lovely to see you both. Right, we are going to do this now. Have we got some music? I say yay. I think I'm on the record as saying I'm not a Star Wars fan. But that's not for now. The reason we're playing it is because there was lots of Star Wars filmed in the Forest of Dean. And today's constituency where we're trying to find a Five Live listener is the Forest of Dean. And we have got a caller on the line. Hello?
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well. Who's that? Is that Caroline?
It is. My name is Caroline. I'm just travelling down now to the Forest of Dean for a mini break for a few days.
You're driving right now to the Forest of Dean?
We are driving through Mid Wales and we're probably about an hour away.
How lovely. So where do you live normally?
So, I live in Manchester now, but I am originally from South Wales.
I was going to say, if you're going from Manchester to the Forest of Dean, why are you in Wales?
Well, because we thought we'd go to Powys Castle today, so that's
very
what we've
nice.
Done
very
on the
nice.
Way down. Yeah.
Very
so, yeah,
nice.
So I drive through this area a lot, down through Simmons Yacht, where we're heading, and that whole corridor to get back to Wales.
Yep, we can tell you in Wales because the phone signal's cutting out. There we are. So, I can still hear you. Why did you pick the Forest of Dean?
Just because we drive through it so much but never actually get to stop. And it's a beautiful part of the world. And it's got lots of different things to do there.
What do you plan to do when you get there? Have you got anything on the itinerary? How long are you there for?
Yes, we have. We're there for 3 days. It's got a beautiful sculpture forest that we're going to explore.
Oh, nice.
Staying on the River Wye, and you can kayak down the River Wye and maybe go to somewhere like Ross-on-Wye or Monmouth. So there's a few different bits to do. It should be good.
All that kayaking sounds like Ed Davies' gap year. The big question coming on is, what is the weather like? Because I'm in Liverpool and the weather is not good.
Yeah, it was
You'd probably be wetter
we
walking
left.
Around than you would if you fell out of your kayak.
I think so, yeah. We'll see what happens with the kayaking. We'll see what the weather's like. But, yeah, I mean, it's overcast, but it's dry. It's been raining, so.
Well, that's the main thing. So you're not driving, obviously, because that would be bad. Who are you travelling to the Forest of Dean?
So, myself and my husband, and it's kind of a big deal for us, this, because we've got a 16-year-old, and we've left him home alone for a few days.
Oh, no, Caroline.
I know.
What have you done?
I have no
How
idea
How will you be able
to
relax in the Forest of Dean when there's Facebook parties being organised in your absence?
Well,
I'm
you
sure,
know, we
I'm
might
sure.
have to make an emergency drive up at midnight one night, but no, I'm
well,
sure it'll be fine.
Best of luck. Caroline, thank you so much for coming on and making your claim to being the MMP for the Forest of Dean. If you can do better,
the
then get in touch.
The UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Very good afternoon. She's Matt Cholley, live from the Labour Party conference in beautiful, beautiful, sunny Liverpool. Coming up, what happened when I went to the pub with some real voters to watch Rachel Reeves' big first speech, first conference speech as Chancellor. We'll do that after we get the news from Jill McKenzie.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, says she'll be fair when making what she calls hard decisions for next month's budget. She promised there'd be no return to austerity in her speech to Labour's conference. The Culture Secretary, Lisa Nandy, was watching and spoke to Matt.
We haven't shied away from the difficult choices that we have to make, and we know that many of those are very difficult for the country. But what the Chancellor painted today was a vision of what we will achieve if we'd set about fixing the foundations. And she painted not just a vision of that today, but a plan to get us there, and that's why we're all feeling so optimistic.
A non-binding conference vote on the government's plan to cut the winter fuel allowance for millions of pensioners has been delayed. It's now expected on Wednesday as the conference is wrapping up. The leader of the Unite Union, Sharon Graham, wants the plan scrapped.
They're trying to move it, I think, after the lights have gone out on Wednesday at some point. And the problem here is it's tin-eared. This is an issue that people want to come to the floor. This motion was ruled out, it's now got ruled back in, and it's now looks like it's been moved to Wednesday when Keir's not here. When the country is talking about winter fuel and what you're doing to pensioners, and you want to shut down a debate at your own conference, that isn't a good look.
Nurses in England have rejected the government's offer of a 5.5% pay rise for this financial year. The Royal College of Nursing said two-thirds voted against it in a record-high turnout of around 145,000. Lebanon's health ministry says at least 180 people have been killed in an intense Israeli bombardment, with more than 700 injured. The Israeli military says it's targeting Hezbollah positions across southern Lebanon. The Iranian-backed group says it's fired dozens of rockets at Israeli military positions. Our Middle East correspondent is Yolande Nell.
Israel has been striking, not just in the south in Lebanon, but also in the east, in the Bekaa Valley. It's warning people there now as well. And it's been striking in the very north, close to the Syrian border. They were saying that this wide